Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. You graduated high school in Drummond, Montana in 2005 and immediately joined the Marine Corps. Less than 1 year later, you were in Iraq, initially with an artillery battalion, and then with a team whose job was to work with local leaders to get basic services and infrastructure rebuilt. After a year back in the U.S., you headed for Afghanistan. At the end of your tour of duty, you go and earn a political science degree at the University of Montana, then work for candidate and then Congressman Ryan Zinke. Now you're starting graduate school, aiming at a master's degree in international relations. You believe that veterans have unique attributes to help our nation solve some serious problems, and you hope to do just that. You're Kip McGuire. Kip, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thank you for having me.
In summary, where did you grow up? What did your folks do?
In summary, I grew up more or less in the Helmville, Montana area. My parents worked for ranches my entire life. My dad was a horse trainer for most of it.
Horse trainer?
A horse trainer, yeah.
Okay, were you involved in any of that growing up?
A little bit, not to any great effect. My mom was a cook and stay-at-home mom for a majority of that.
Any siblings?
I've got one sister. She's a year older than me. She currently has three kids and married in Deer Lodge, Montana.
In the materials you gave me, it looked like you moved around Montana quite a bit. Was that based on your dad's work?
It was.
If I asked you in that childhood and in teenage years before you graduated from Drummond, what were the key values you learned, the key attributes that you had or qualities? What would you say?
Hard work would definitely be one. That's in the ranch communities. I mean, the hard work is what everybody gets by on, and I'd say ingenuity would probably be the other one.
Where did that come from?
Just keeping ranches up and running and stuff. You know, everybody's on a budget, and they're trying to get by with spending as little as they can and being as productive as they can. And so sometimes that leads to some pretty ingenious fixes for things that you wouldn't normally see. So.
Why the Marines immediately after high school?
There really is no reason that I can think of. My granddad and my dad were both Marines, and so there was a little bit of a history there. Neither of them ever really talked about it. Neither one was a war veteran by any means, but they had both served in the Marine Corps, and so there's a history there. But I don't know. I wanted to go to college and play basketball, and that became apparent that that wasn't going to happen. So the next thing that I decided to do was the Marine Corps.
I'm guessing you had some sort of expectations of what it would be like, even though your dad and granddad didn't talk about it much. You took the step. Surprises initially, what you expected? What was the experience like, boot camp, for example?
Boot camp was pretty much what I expected. I definitely did some research, you know, and At the time, you know, the internet was out, and so I started doing some research on there about what boot camp would be like and things of that nature. And
in advance?
In advance, yeah. It was pretty much in line with what I figured it would be. A lot of physical training, and there's definitely mental points in boot camp where, especially as an 18-year-old, you know, first time really being away from home and friends and stuff like that, you have a lot of mental realizations that are going on there.
Give me an example of one.
Just one. I remember that there was one day that we really weren't doing anything. We were just kind of cleaning our squad bay in boot camp. And for whatever reason, I got really homesick that day. Almost a soul-crushing kind of a homesickness that that came over me. But, you know, I got past it. And ever since then, you know, the rest of boot camp, it was just kind of easy. You just kind of came to terms with it and realized that you were okay, and it wasn't really that big of a deal. So
it's interesting. My recollection is that the process is intentional and psychological. Some people say to break down the individual's former frames of associations to build, then rebuild that around the Marine Corps, that there's a serious reorientation. Would you say that's a fair summary, or can you summarize it better, or it's just not true? What would you say?
No, I'd say that's an excellent summary. Like I say, the overall point of boot camp there is to exactly like you're saying, break down some of the mental barriers that we have as young men and women, and to rebuild that around the Marine Corps and show you that there are different ways of living than what you have in the past.
You get orders in March 2007 to go to Iraq. Now, the war broke out, I think, in 2003. It's the basic combat between the Iraqi and the American forces, armed forces, is over, and it's more a guerrilla-type situation. Is that fair?
Yeah. In 2007 there, well, really in 2005, 2006, was whenever Al-Qaeda in Iraq had really taken over, and so the U.S. military had kind of started shifting away from the war with Saddam's forces and really started focusing on the counter-guerrilla operations going on in Iraq.
And would you say that your training, how well or in what areas had your training prepared you for what you walked into?
It was good. We spent almost a full year training for the mission that we were doing there. We were initially an artillery battalion, and then they told us that we were going to go do civil affairs in Iraq. And so we spent almost a full year with specifically civilians and other military personnel who had trained for a lot longer on civil affairs to teach us how to properly do that mission. And so we did a full year of training on that.
And so before you go there or when you're there?
Before we got there.
Really? Okay, because you started out in artillery, right?
Right, right.
And then shifted to this sort of civilian interface, what'd you call it?
So it's still definitely a military operation, but it's a military operation for winning hearts and minds. I mean, that's where that phrase is coined, is by civil affairs. So
I see. Okay. Now, if I'm understanding you, I mean, I go back, hearts and minds goes back to the Vietnam War, which was my college years and post-college years. The idea was that the military could serve a constructive purpose that was a prolonged war, like the war in Iraq, some similarities and some differences, but there were efforts made to win over guerrilla sympathetic villagers or neutral elements of the South Vietnamese society, with the military providing them security and some improvements to their lives. Is that what we're talking about?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Tell us about it. You're dealing with Sunni and Shia religions in different communities in Iraq, fair, that don't tend to get along too well?
Yeah, the religious differences were definitely there. Our teams operated in pretty specific areas, so there wasn't a whole lot of major religious differences there.
Okay.
It was a lot more to do with tribal differences, because each area will have multiple tribes within it, and so the tribes will have, you know, individual family and tribal histories and feuds going on that are at a lower level than what the overall religious differences are.
You're listening to Homeground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with former Marine and currently graduate student Kip McGuire. So the nuts and bolts were what? What were you trying to get these folks to do in cooperation with the United States and the United States Marine Corps?
So our mission as civil affairs was to basically go in, and like I say, I mean, the overall mission was summed up by the win hearts and minds. And so the way that we do that is we would go in and we would try to build a relationship, a rapport with the local tribal, religious, and political leaders, and just get a dialogue going. And once we established that dialogue, we'd try and bring it out from them of what the local people needed as far as infrastructure rebuilding, schools, roads, sewage, things of that nature.
Okay, so you guys don't do that kind of work, right?
No, we don't.
So I'm a tribal leader and I say, we need sewage disposals in this town.
So we were a direct element involved with the comptroller for Iraq. And so what we would do is we would liaison between the local officials that we talk to after they've told us what they need in their region, and we would find local Iraqi contractors that could provide the services and actually do the construction projects and bring the equipment in to do these projects. We'd bid that out, we'd award the bid to the lowest bidder, and then we would fund the project. And so through the comptroller, we would pay the contractor at certain points during the progress, and at the same token, they'd, you know, get the project done for the locals.
What was your experience for the projects the Marine Corps supervised? Did you get them done?
You know, for the most part, they got done. It definitely had challenges just because, you know, the Iraqis at the time would pretty much come to us, and they wouldn't actually tell us what the people needed. They'd come to us and just say, you know, whatever you're willing to give us. And so it was very difficult coming up with projects that were actually what the people needed. But for the most part, whenever we did find out what they needed, we'd get it in there and they'd get accomplished.
Now, you and I have chatted, and I have frankly found the discussion very, very interesting, so I'll be raising some issues from what you told me. You personally facilitated, at age of approximately 20 years old, the meetings between your team, and you worked in a team, with these various village leaders, tribal leaders, religious leaders.
Right.
Okay. I've done a fair amount of facilitation. It's a process of building mutual trust and confidence among the players, in my case, timber, environmental, government people. The idea of facilitating a discussion across not just U.S.-Iraqi cultures, which are obviously have very different histories, but you're wearing a military uniform. You represent an occupying force, maybe liberating, maybe not, depending on who's looking, right? Depending on the Iraqi who's looking across the table at you. How did it feel? A waste of time?
I don't think it was a waste of time by any means, but it definitely got frustrating. We'd have to take a much more proactive part in this than what we would have liked, I think. We'd spend a lot of time actually out in the regions of the city or the area that we were in to proactively find what they might need and then kind of try to drop hints to the local leaders of, do you need a school here maybe? And then they'd turn around and say, oh yeah, a school would be great. And
so what do you attribute their reluctance to? Lack of trust?
I don't think it was a lack of trust. I think that honestly, they saw it as kind of a cash cow.
Okay.
And they didn't want to throw anything out there that we might reject. And so instead, they were just kind of playing the coy part and willing to accept anything that we would throw out there. So
we've got a lot of ground to cover, and I just want to summarize something that was fascinating to me that you wrote in your summary. You're part of a civil affairs group or CAG team of roughly 14 Marines, and you do everything in that group. It's a self-contained unit, and you're on your own. You go on convoys. You're the head machine gunner to provide security. Fair summary?
Yes.
Okay, now that's like not my kind of facilitation, right? In other words, it's taking place in an environment that is war zone. It sort of jarred my preconceptions of what goes on. It's a mixture of military and civilian. How did that strike you? Logical? Crazy? Both?
Given the circumstances, I think that it was logical. At that point in time, we didn't take part in any major combat, I guess. We weren't out there, you know, assaulting houses and stuff like that, or we tried to avoid it at all cost. Just because the locals, especially in tribal areas like this, they all see what units are coming through and they recognize which units are there. And so it got to the point where they knew we were civil affairs, they knew who we were. And so whenever we came into an area, they kind of recognized that we were the guys coming in to build that relationship. We weren't the guys coming in to kick in doors.
What was your sense for that situation you just described? The Iraqi ability, these are the guys that are helping us, these are the guys that are fighting maybe our friends or maybe our enemies, depending on which side they're on in that fractured society. That is not a simple situation to be in, it seems to me. Looking back, how do you see the policy, the practice, the assumption of winning hearts and minds of serious people in this fractured situation where they know the convoy? That's a convoy that's a fighting convoy. This is a convoy that might be part of the cash cow that we can do some good for our community or whatever, or maybe make some money for a contractor. Functional or hopeless? You follow me?
I do. And you know, and that does get complex. I think that it could be functional. And I think that to some level it was. You know, there are definitely Iraqis that were there that were very glad we were there and very much had the mindset that they wanted democracy. But at the same token, like you say, I mean, we're fighting eons and eons of tribal society there. And so it's going to be a very long process of actually having that seed of democracy develop in these places where, yeah, for the last multiple thousands of years, that democracy hasn't been there. And so they've got that tribal mindset.
Okay, we're going to get back to this, because one of the observations you made that struck me as highly interesting that I mentioned in the introduction was your feeling that military veterans and combat veterans have something special to contribute to the solving the problems of this nation. And what you just said raises questions in my mind about how that happens. In other words, that's a shift. We're talking about, in your case, a guy that's experienced in Iraq, and we're going to talk about Afghanistan, and you believe you personally can make a contribution to this country's problems, which we look at it and it's a different world, it's, quote, democratic, it's peaceful society. You see the confusion, it just seems to me it's an interesting and provocative belief that you have. You want to say anything about it before we get to Afghanistan?
I mean, I think that we're going to discuss this more here in a minute, but just to sum it up and give a quick example, I mean, a good example is, you know, while I was in college, I bounced at a bar in Missoula for many years, and everybody thought that it was hilarious watching me bounce, because they always said that I had way too much patience, that, you know, a lot of guys should have gotten thrown out of the bar, and I'd sit there and talk them down, sort of a thing. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the major reasons why I had that patience was just for the fact that in Iraq, whenever you're in one of those standoff situations where things are getting tense and people are tensed up and, yep, and getting a little hostile, it's automatic weapons involved. You know, it's not as easy as there's just going to be a brawl. It could end in, you know, people dying. And so you've got to have that patience. And I think little lessons like mm-hmm. that come over to the leadership and what war veterans have to offer.
Very interesting. We'll come back to that. You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with former U.S. Marine and Iraqi and Afghan veteran and citizen Kip McGuire. Now you go to Afghanistan. What happens?
In Afghanistan, whenever we came back from Iraq, we stood back up as an artillery battalion. Really didn't need artillery in Afghanistan at the time, so we became the brigade headquarters group, which we were just responsible for building a base in southern Afghanistan called Camp Leatherneck. Eventually, due to multiple reasons, I got detached from that unit and put into an embedded training team, which means that I went and lived in Kabul with a new Afghan army unit that was being stood up, and we mentored them and taught them how to be soldiers, basically.
Okay, very quickly, because we got a lot of ground to cover when you get back to the States and the issues that your experience raises. There's been, I'd say, basically very skeptical reporting in the press. I'm not in a position to say that it's factual or not, about the efficacy of bringing the Afghan forces up to combat readiness, quote-unquote, in fighting the people that we were fighting when we were over there in more active combat. What's your sense for that?
You know, I think that we're doing a lot of good. I think a lot of the training that we do with them is beneficial. But again, you know, there's social structures there that it's going to take a lot of time for them to come to terms with within their own society before it really takes hold.
Seems to me your comments on the deepness of the different history of those countries between themselves and between them and us raises a fundamental question. And that is, A, can we change those societies? Do we have any business trying to change those societies? And B, is the military the best tool to do it? Now, you're no longer in the military. You're just beginning studying international relations, which seems to me to reflect the fact that you're interested in that question, how international relations can work better. What would you say to that? Was the military trying to make the best of a situation that they were put into and had no control over? Or is it a viable tool? It doesn't sound, would you say, it's going to take a long time, very expensive for us, just on that side of it.
I think that it was, you know, in the words that you just used, the best for the situation that they were put into. I mean, my personal thoughts on it are that thoughts like democracy have to be much more organic. You know, these are concepts that society has to come up with and really come to terms with on their own. It can't be forced on them by somebody else.
You come back to the States, what happens?
I came back to the States 45 days after I was back here from Afghanistan. I was officially out of the Marine Corps, and I came back to Montana for college.
What did you study?
Political science.
Why?
Honestly, kind of being lazy to start out with. I wanted to go into physics and realized it would take me about 5 to 6 years to get caught up on my math there, and discovered I could get political science done in 3 years, so I went with political science initially.
Did you learn anything in political science that was important to your future, do you think?
Oh, absolutely.
What?
I definitely came to appreciate the political process and the history of how the United States developed and I guess the thought process that was put into it by the founders for why they founded this nation the way they did.
Very interesting. You mentioned here that during that time, that is in the materials you've provided me, that you were a bartender and you talked about being a bouncer. Were there any parallels at all, contrasts, whatever? What did you learn as a bartender?
I think bartending and bouncing is just an immense opportunity to study human nature. You're seeing people there that are in an altered state of mind often, and you've got to interact with that, and you've got to deal with them as a patron and a customer at the same token. And so there's a lot of diplomacy going on in a bar.
Very interesting. Very, very interesting. I'll have to interview a bartender sometime. But it just strikes me there's a parallel with your Iraqi experience in civil affairs and the bartender. You gave an example of talking people down in a much more volatile situation, but the principle was somewhat the same. You are communicating and getting people to settle down and think more rationally when they're in an abnormal state of mind. Fair?
Absolutely.
Now, you go to work for candidate and then Congressman Zinke. What have you learned in that period of time that you didn't know before, or what did it confirm for you?
Some of the things that I learned from being with candidate and then Congressman Ryan Zinke is just the realities that go into politics, I guess.
Meaning what?
Especially on the campaign side, in 2014, whenever I was working with him there, what it takes to get somebody elected and how fickle the American people are. One of the major rules is that you've got about 45 seconds of somebody's attention span. And so if you can't sum it up in those 45 seconds, just our society today, they're not going to pay attention.
Now, how does that strike you in relation to the expectations of the founders?
I think that they'd be appalled by it. Thomas Jefferson was a huge advocate for involvement and being involved. I think that all the founders were, but Thomas Jefferson sticks out in my mind. There's a quote of his that I'm probably going to butcher, but it had something along the lines of you'll be a free nation as long as you stay an involved nation. And I think that in a lot of ways, we've definitely fallen away from that involvement.
Yeah, I think that the founders would not believe it's possible to develop an informed citizenry, which they felt was the foundation of the Democratic Republic, with 45-second sound bites, a lot of them negative characters, assassination kind of stuff of the opposition. So faced with that fundamental problem, and maybe some others, why does the guy decide to go into graduate school in international relations? What do you hope to end up learning in that next step of your very interesting life?
I've come to believe that relationships are the most critical thing in, I guess, the human experience here. I mean, the relationships that we build between each other and how we interact with each other. And really, that's where I think most human progress comes from, is those relationships and collaborations, as I'm sure you would say. And so international relations is just the natural step, I think, to go into for exploring those relationship building tools and to see how to facilitate building relationships.
Now, that's very interesting to me in the following sense. My experience as a facilitator is it works very well at an individual level with responsible representatives of divergent interests. International relations is that in spades. It's across all your examples from Iraq and Afghanistan jump out in terms of the cultural profound differences and yet we're a global world and we need to figure out ways to get along, if I'm hearing you correctly.
Absolutely.
Okay. And do you also believe that your experience and other veterans' experience in war, in which is the antithesis of what we think of as normal walking down the street life, is a useful experience to bridge gaps between people? Now, can you explain that? You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Well, you're taking this situation where facilitates the opposite of collaboration. It's war. Useful experience to help for the people who've gone through it. What are we talking about?
Well, and you know, I mean, really, I think that goes into one of the old adages that you can't appreciate the light if you haven't seen the darkness. And so I'm not saying that war is a good thing by any means, but it is a reality, and we need to study that reality. And a lot of the things that come out of that reality are, you know, leadership capabilities. These young men and women coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan are decision makers. I mean, these are people that at the ages of 18 to 30, mostly, were dropped off in the deserts of Iraq and the mountains of Afghanistan. And I mean, they were the ones that coordinated the logistics. They were the ones that they ran airfields, built bases the size of cities, ran everything on those bases, did security, and waged war against the enemy all at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so in a 4 to 8 year span after you're out of high school, that's an immense amount of life packed into a short amount of time.
I think it's clear that you apply that definition to yourself. What do you want to be able to say looking back on what you've done with your life?
You know, I'm going to go to something that General Washington said at one point in time, and I can't remember where I saw this, but he said that everybody has the duty to attain the greatest station that they can, whether that be a cobbler or president of the United States. And so looking back, I hope to say that I gained the greatest station I could in life, and that I had the largest impact for good while I was here. Leave this place better than I found it.
Kip McGuire, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground, and I wish you success. To our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.